Let's get started on Chapter 17, Projecting Cash Flow and Earnings. Or if you have the third edition, it's called Financial Statements and Ratio Analysis. What'd they do? Yeah, in the fourth edition, they pulled this chapter out, stuck it at the end, and then replaced chapter 7, that chapter 7 with something a little sillier, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. Did chapter 6, the dividend discount model, did they traumatize you? Well, this is actually a little easier than chapter 6. We're going to deal mainly with financial statements and ratio analysis. It is important enough to warrant our attention, and we will look at all the ratios, but we'll only compute a few. We will skip the forecasting because we already did something very similar to that when we looked at the price ratio models and the like. So let's get started. Slide number 2. There are three financial statements, balance sheet happens to be one of them, that are very important. In fact, by law, every publicly traded company must produce these financial statements every quarter, and then they must come up with a yearly report. The balance sheet is the financial summary of a firm's assets, liabilities, and shareholders' equity at a given point in time. So we take our assets, subtract our liabilities, and what's left over is our equity. Some of you who've taken the financial planning and money management class, you remember this as the net worth statement. And if you've taken accounting, relax. Please don't go screaming into the night. We're not going to do journal entries and trial balances. No. That's done by the accountants. So if you do have accounting experience, this is going to seem like a piece of cake. And in fact, the more accounting experience you have, the better you are able to make your way around these financial statements. The cash flow statement, it used to be called a profit and loss, I guess some people still call it that, is the summary of the operating results of a firm covering a specified period of time, usually 3 months, the quarterly results, and then the 1 year annual results. In the financial planning class, we call it the cash flow statement. Ooh, the accountants cringe when we use the term cash flow statement for their income statement, because to them, a statement of cash flows, as it is sometimes called, we call it the cash flow statement, is something very different. That's the third financial statement, and that's the summary of a firm's cash flow and other events that caused changes in the company's cash position. Again, quarterly and annually. So we will see that the cash flow statement starts where the income statement ends, and we'll discuss why. On the website are three financial statements for Walgreens. Have you heard of them? Yeah, one of the big, drugstore chains throughout the United States. So you're going to want to have those available as we go through these two presentations. Slide number 3 concentrates on the balance sheet. So if you want to, you should. Just grab it or put it on the screen somewhere if you have a big enough screen so you can refer back to it. The balance sheet is a snapshot of our financial position. Assets are anything that a company owns that has value. Liabilities are the firm's financial obligations. Equity is what's left over after you take assets minus liabilities and you're left with equity. Now, sometimes the accountants will write the formula as we see it here on the slide. Assets equals liability plus equity. Same idea. And what the accountants do is they differentiate between current and long term. Excuse me. Current being anything up to a year. Now, often we investors, we think of short term being up to a year or so, intermediate term 2, 3, 4 years, maybe 5, and long term being 5 or more. But no, the accountants say no. It's either current assets, current liabilities, meaning you're going to consume them or use them within a year, or they are long term, greater than 1 year. So remember that little difference. And take a look at Walgreens, and you'll find that Walgreens is a company after my own heart. Why? Because they have very little long-term debt. Yes. Now, we'll discuss short-term versus long-term. Concurrent versus long-term, and we'll see that debt is very important to keep track of, because if you can't make your short-term liabilities, oh boy, things are not good. Slide number 4. The income statement. The income statement shows our revenues, income, and our expenses. The difference between a company's revenues and expenses, that's the amount we use to pay dividends to shareholders or we keep as retained earnings within the company to finance future growth. So the formula is net income equals revenue minus expenses. And this is what we report to the world as our earnings. And specifically, most importantly, we report this to the IRS because we're a corporation and we have to pay taxes. But some income and expenses are not always received or paid in cash. We discussed this before, remember? When we talked about good quality and poor quality earnings? Right, if a company has depreciation, well, that lowers your income and you pay fewer dollars to the IRS in terms of taxes, but you didn't actually write a check out to depreciation. No. So take a look at the Walgreens income statement and you'll see that the last few years for Walgreens have been pretty darn good. They've been increasing their revenue. As the country comes out of recession, it would make sense that retailers such as Walgreens would do so, and that's exactly what's happening. But as we said, you know, that income that we report to the IRS doesn't necessarily report how much cash we have on hand, what's happening in our checkbook, our corporate checkbook. And for that reason, we take a look at the statement of cash flows, or usually just called the cash flow statement, slide number 5. It's the income realized in cash form. So these things get a little tricky. When you take a look at it, you will see, and of course this is where the, my apologies, this is where the accountants have it over us, right, when they start blabbering. And I took accounting a long, long time ago, and after I left, I got good grades, don't get me wrong, but after I left that class, I said, I ain't never going to do that for a living unless somebody pays me a whole lot of money. If you take a look at the cash flow statement for Walgreens, you'll see it begins where the income statement ends. And then they add back certain items, specifically look at the depreciation, that's the biggie. And they take out certain items, such as non-cash items, operating cash flow items, investment cash flow items, and financing cash flow items. Very important to understand whether the checkbook balance is going up or whether the checkbook balance is going down. As we said in the previous presentation, we talked about companies that were generating record earnings, and yet their cash flow was going down. That doesn't make any sense. You're making all this money and you're not really making the money, are you? You're selling the equipment as Lucent Technologies did to all these telecommunication startups, but you're not getting the cash because you are playing the part of the bank for these startups and they're going to pay you the $2 billion over 20 years And then after the second year, they close up shop, give you back your equipment, and you're in deep trouble. Slide number 6. Where do we get these financial statements? Well, as we said, every company must disclose this information on an annual basis. That's called a 10K. And a quarterly basis, that's called a 10Q. 10Q? You're welcome. Sorry. And the system is under Regulation FD, Fair Disclosure, which requires companies to make public disclosures of material information fairly. And what does this mean? Well, before Regulation FD came into effect, companies could have these private meetings, or sometimes they were public, but they were only attended by Wall Street analysts and mutual fund analysts, and they would get information before the general public would get that information. And the SEC said, look, this is not fair, folks. This is not right. So now what happens, and of course the internet has made life a lot easier for these companies. So now what happens is they schedule an earnings call, and that was part of your assignment for Chapter 5, right? To listen to these things. Now, you probably didn't listen to them live, but the earnings call is scheduled for a set date and time, and it's live, folks. And that time is when the data is shot out into the internet. So when the earnings call starts, the financial statements become available, the 10Ks, the 10Qs become available, and everybody gets the information at the same time. Make sense? Yeah. And then there are countless other sources. We looked at the value line, but I've heard many investors opine that nowadays there is simply too much information. It's, you know, all day long, into the evening, and all overnight. They just never stop beating the drum. Give me a break, will you? There's a wonderful writer. You probably won't read his books, because he mostly writes for stockbrokers and financial advisors and the like. But he has a wonderful saying. He says, wisdom sold separately. You understand? Sure, there's plenty of data out there. There's plenty of opinions and some of the articles, just ridiculous. I don't bother to read them. Just look at the headline, you'll know it. Can Apple go higher? Yeah, it can go higher. It can also go lower, or it can stay the same. Is the market overvalued? Well, maybe the market's overvalued. Maybe the market's not overvalued. They don't actually say the market is overvalued. No, they don't say that, because then they can be wrong. Slide number 7. Now, we're going to turn our attention to financial ratios. And we've already done some financial ratios, folks. We're going to review the ones we've done and then do other ones. Financial ratios are a relation between two financial quantities expressed as the quotient of one divided by the other. And, of course, ratio analysis is the study of the relationships between financial statement accounts. And if you remember our discussion or discussions of financial ratios, please recall that there is, I got two that's. Recall that. I'll fix that. I'll fix that. Write that down in case I forget. Recall that there is no one ratio that can accurately sum up the overall state of a company, right? Every ratio must be considered in the context of all the information gathered. Plus, you must consider any ratio in the context of the industry the company exists within. So what I'm saying here is, folks, you can't just say, ooh, look at this ratio. Ooh, this is why I'm going to buy this stock, or this is why I'm going to sell this stock. No, it's a stew, right? You have to look at all of them. And then you have to look at their competitors and the industry and the market as a whole. So there are sometimes when a ratio pops out at you and says, look at me. And we'll see examples of that. And that doesn't mean you should buy it or sell it. It means you need to do more research. It means you need to try to understand why this company is so different than its competitors within the industry and the market as a whole. And we'll see an example of this soon. Slide number 8. The common stock ratios. Now, most of these we've already discussed, and we'll review them quickly. These are financial ratios that convert the key information about a firm to a per-share basis. And many of these are on either the summary sheet of Yahoo or Bloomberg, or the key statistics, right? The key statistics page. They're also called the market ratios. And so we've discussed PE, right? We'll take a look at the PEG ratio, which is just a way to relate the PE to the growth rate of the company. Dividends per share, dividend yield, dividend payout ratio, right? These are familiar, right? Book value per share, and price to book, price to cash flow, and price to sale. So we've used all of these, except for the PEG ratio. We've already taken a look at all these. So let's review them fairly quickly. Slide number 9, the PE ratio, right? It's a very simple statistic. You take the price of a stock and you divide it by its earnings. Excuse me. I've been fighting something. My voice probably sounds a little funny. The most popular stock market statistic. Historically, PE ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies. And historically, greater than 20 was unusual. But today, it's not unusual. Of course, in the late 1990s, they were in the hundreds or thousands. The PE ratio also tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no change in earnings, for the company to earn back its price. So if you have a PE of 3, which is very unusual these days, that means in 3 years the company is going to earn back its price. Now, that doesn't mean anything else, folks. It doesn't mean you're going to get that money back in the form of dividends, or it doesn't mean that the company's going to do well or anything, but that's just in and of itself what it means, a PE of 3. 3 years, it'll earn back its price. And nothing else changes, and of course, things are changing all the time. A PE of 20 will take 20 years. A PE of 10,000, as eBay had in, whatever, 1999 or so. Yeah, right. Okay, so let's now move to slide number 10, and take a look at some PEs of companies as of the 27th of February. You've heard of all these companies, right? Exxon, Google, maybe not Amgen, very big biotech company, JP Morgan Chase, right? General Mills, Bristol Myers, and wait a minute, what's going on here? Google is over 20. Well, that's a growth stock, right? Exxon is 10. What's going on? Aren't gas prices really high? I mean, shouldn't an energy company have a much bigger PE? Amgen and General Mills, Bristol Myers, 15, 16. Well, that's not real high, but it's not very low. And then JP Morgan Chase, 8. What's going on? Well, these companies are all in different industries. What we need to do is compare these companies to other companies in their sector of the economy. So look at what happens when we fill in the the blanks here. Look at the energy companies. Exxon had the highest PE with 10. And Chevron and ConocoPhillips, 8. 8.5, and BP, 6. Why? Yeah, they're still recovering from their the black eye that was given to them by the Gulf spill a few years ago. Look at Google. Well, it's commanding a better PE, a higher PE than Yahoo, which people are not as excited about. But who is Sohu and Baidu and... Right, these are the companies that are competing with Google and Yahoo in the Far East, specifically China. And investors are not too excited about Sohu's prospects, but Baidu? Whee! Over twice the PE of Google. Right. And then let's now sneak down to the banks. Let's sort of go in clockwise here. J.P. Morgan had the slowest P.E. ratio of Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and U.S. Bank. Well, Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank did not get involved as much, I mean a little bit, but as much with the financial shenanigans that went on in the mid-2000s, and they didn't get hurt as much. So people, investors, are more willing to bid up the price relative to the earnings for those two companies, Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank, than they are for J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup. And now let's, again, let's go counterclockwise. Look at the drug companies. Bristol-Myers Squibb is a drug company, and they have a P.E. of 15. Pfizer, a little bit higher, and Merck even a little bit higher than that, but still fairly close. But then we see Eli Lilly, 10. Well, now, what's going on here, huh? Well, this is where what we were discussing just a few slides ago. That doesn't mean you should buy Eli Lilly because it has a lower P.E., and so it's safer. It doesn't mean you should buy Merck or Pfizer because they have a higher P.E. and therefore they have a better prospects for the future. What it means is you need to do more research. And you need to keep this in mind, but look at everything else that's available to you. And not make a decision based on one statistic. Does that make sense? I hope so. Coming around again, clockwise form, we find that the food companies are all fairly close to one another. Kraft is a little higher. Personally, I think that's because I think investors are kind of excited about Kraft's major push into the developing world. Globally, I mean, they're already a global company, but they're really pushing, which is, you know, putting them head to head with Nestle. And so, maybe investors, I'm just guessing, folks, I don't know, you have to go out and ask all of them. But still, it's fairly close, 16, almost 16 and a half, 15 and a half, 17, 19, they're all fairly close. Now the last one, what's going on here? Well, folks, these are biotechnology companies. So what would we expect? Exactly. We would expect high PEs, plus in one case, whoa, look at this, Illumina, I think it's actually pronounced. So Biogen IDEC, which used to be based here in San Diego, but now it's based in Boston area. Life Technologies, very healthy PEs. People are very, investors are very optimistic about their future. Doesn't mean they're right. We'll come back in 3 to 5 years and see what happens. And so they're commanding higher PEs than Amgen, which is a more stodgy, if you can use the word stodgy with biotechnology, biotech company, more established, but the prospects for exponential growth are not as strong. And then Illumina, which must have some really hot new drug that's ready to be approved by the FDA, and if it is, oh, the sky's the limit, and if it isn't, oh well, the parachutes had better be very, very large, because that PE could drop like a stone, right, as the price drops like a stone. Make sense? And this is what I hope you will find as you do your research. You will not just for PE, but for all the statistics. You'll look at the individual company and then look at its competitors and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Or no, that makes sense. It's in line with its competitors. Yeah. Okay. Slide number 11. How can we account for the wide PE disparity between different industries and different companies within industry? Again, as we've said in the past, it is the expectation of future earnings and dividend growth by investors. But it's also a little bit more. There's a lot of psychology involved and maybe a lot of hype, as we'll see when we get to chapters 7 and 8. And this is a quote by Jack Dreyfus, who is the founder of the Dreyfus Funds, which is now associated with the Bank of New York. It's taken from A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Now, this was written in the 60s, folks, so the technologies were, you know, emerging technologies were different, technologies that we take for granted now, but let's read it together. Take a nice little company that has been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings. Change the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, the words electronics and silicon are worth 15x earnings. However, the real play comes from the word firth burners, which no one understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your score. Therefore, we have 6x earnings for the shoelace business, 15x earnings for electronics and silicone, or a total of 21 earnings. Multiply this by 2 for firth burners, and we now have a score of 42x earnings for the new company. Do you catch the humor involved? And today, of course, we replace the word firth burners with nanotechnology, and we replace electronics and silicon with social networking and China. Nothing. The technology changes, folks, but people don't change. Slide number 12. The PEG ratio. The PEG ratio? The PEG ratio is not often quoted, but what it's trying to do is compare the PE ratio to the rate of growth. And if you remember, we discussed the PE ratio and the growth rate of the company, and we said that traditionally a PE ratio was supposed to mirror or equal the great rate of growth. So the PEG ratio just turns that into a number. You take the PE ratio and divide it by the growth rate, either 3 to year or 5 year expected growth rate. And if it's equal to 1, that means they're equal, right? Whatever the PE ratio is, 20 over 20% growth rate or 10 over 10% growth rate, you would wind up with 1. Historically, a PEG ratio of 1 was desirable since it meant that the PE ratio equaled the growth rate. And anything above 1, well, that was considered high. But now, greater than 1 is common, and less than 1. You can find companies whose PE ratio is less than their growth rate. And assuming that their growth rate continues, that's a pretty darn good sign, don't we think? So you'll hear people talk about the PEG ratio, and all you need to understand, is that if it's 1, then the PE ratio is equal to its growth rate. If it's greater than 1, the PE ratio is greater than the growth rate. And if it's less than 1, the PE ratio is less than the growth rate. That's what it's trying to discuss. Slide number 12, dividends per share. Well, we discussed that, right? Take the annual dividends and divide that by the number of shares outstanding. Dividends became taboo during the 1990s. Oh, no, we don't want dividends. We want you to reinvest the money back into the company and grow our earnings per share and grow our stock price. We want capital gains. But since the 2000 to 2002 bear market, investors have changed their minds about dividends. Dividends can be discussed in polite company again. Slide number 14, the dividend yield. Again, we've already discussed this, right? You take the dividends per share, divide it by the stock market price. And this important statistic allows an investor to compare a company to other forms of investments that pay income, such as savings accounts or bonds. And traditionally, 4 to 6 was considered good. Maybe a little less or zero for very, you know, fast-growing companies, and more than 6 or 7, that's unusual. Currently, the S&P 500 as a whole is yielding just over 2%, 2.2 or something like that, while the 10-year Treasury bonds are yielding less than 2%. How often does that happen? Very rare. It is usually, folks, a great sign for stocks as a whole if the S&P 500 is yielding over the 10-year Treasury bond. And, of course, savings accounts are yielding practically nothing. I've seen them 0.01. 0.01? Why even bother? 0.01 is pennies. It's ridiculous. But, excuse me, some stocks are paying much more than 2%, folks. You know, some really great stocks paying 3, 4%. And many growth stocks, of course, are paying nothing. And there's a kerfuffle right now over Apple and what they're going to do with their $100 billion of cash. It's time, Apple, to pay dividends. And this happened several years ago with Intel and Microsoft. Microsoft was sitting on $60, $70 billion of cash. And people said, when are you going to start paying it back? And they finally did. They finally just started paying it out as dividends. So this is what happens. Companies go through their major growth spurts, and then they all of a sudden are sitting on tons of cash, and they decide, well, what can we do with it? Well, we can earn less than 1% at the bank, which is what's going on. Well, not the bank. They use corporate paper and other types of short-term investments, like mutual funds do, because you're talking about billions of dollars. They can buy other companies, which not always a good idea, unless it's a wonderful fit. It usually is a bad sign. Or they can give it to shareholders, which I like dividends. Slide number 15, the dividend payout ratio is the measure of how much of a company's earnings are being paid out to shareholders in the form of dividends. And we've already calculated this. You take dividends per share and divide it by the earnings per share. More mature companies often pay out almost all their earnings in the form of dividends. Why? They don't need the cash anymore. They've developed the product. How many times can Microsoft rewrite Windows in Office? I wish they'd stop. Every time they do it, they make it worse. I can't stand this machine with Windows 7. I want to go back to XP. Maybe I should just go get an Apple. Growing companies retain their earnings because they need to reinvest. And you accountants know that's called retained earnings. Right. Slide number 16. Book value per share. This is a measure of the net worth of a company on a per share basis. This should be familiar. You looked it up in Chapter 5. You take the common stockholders' equity, in other words, what the business owns, and you divide it by the number of shares outstanding. The book value per share tells an investor how much assets are behind each share of stock. In other words, what's the net worth? That's the term we use in the financial planning class. In other words, if all the assets of the company were liquidated, how much would each shareholder receive? It is common for the actual market price of a share to be above the book value per share, since the company is worth more intact than if it were dissolved. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Think of a pizza store, pizza restaurant. Right. I mean, how much are the assets worth? Not a whole lot compared to the worth of the company as a going concern, as a business in business to make money. I mean, sure, you could sell the restaurant equipment, and you could sell maybe the tables and the chairs and the stuff, but no. And this is true of most companies, folks. Today, it is common for the market price to be far above the book value, and it just makes sense. Isn't Coca-Cola worth more intact than if you sold off all the assets, paid off the debts? Yeah, it is. When a company's book value becomes greater than the market price, then there's a real danger of the company being raided. They're called corporate raiders, right? Takeover artists and the like. They liquidate the company, pay off all the debts, and walk away with money in their pocket. That's capitalism. Slide number 7. Price to book value per share. So here we go, folks. This is a review. We take the market price and divide it by the book value per share. Given that the book value per share is often less than the market price, the price to book value per share tells an investor how far above the book value the market is. So if it's equal to 1, then that means the price and the book value are the same. today, as we said, 3 or 4 are not uncommon. Some are much higher. Some are much lower. So, and during the 2008-2009 turmoil, many companies were selling for less than their book value. Many companies that you would not think of. You ever hear of Toyota or Sony or Honda or Panasonic? These major, large Japanese companies were selling for less than their book value. Unbelievable. Okay, slide number 18. The price to cash flow. Look familiar from chapter 6? Right. You take the current price divided by the current cash flow per share, and as we've said, cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons, but the most common reason is depreciation, because depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure. But there are many reasons that cash flow and earnings differ, and we talked about good quality versus poor quality earnings. Right, take the current price divided by the cash flow per share, and if that is very high, then investors believe that the prospects for the company are good. Doesn't mean they're right. And as we said, during the internet mania, many companies were reporting record earnings. At the same time, their cash flow was negative. How could that be? Yeah, they made very bad business decisions. And our last one for this current presentation will be the price to sales. Again, all review. The current price divided by the annual sales per share, historically a higher price to sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth rate, and vice versa. And during the internet mania, many analysts used price to sales instead of price to earnings, since most all the new companies never generated any earnings. So these were all review. When we come back, we will take a look at ratios that we have not discussed yet. And those are the profitability, liquidity, activity, and leverage ratios. Okay? And in the assignment, I'm going to ask you to calculate some of these. Now, the ones we just did, the common stock, the market ratios, excuse me, are often the easiest ones to find. You don't have to do the calculations. In the next section, we'll find that a few of them are often reported very, very commonly, but others you have to dig in and do the calculations for yourself, and they're pretty darn easy, folks, so don't get too worried. It's certainly not as hard as the Chapter 6 dividend discount models. So we'll see you next time when we discuss the ratios that we haven't covered yet.